you, Tanya. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the RRTPD Working Group call on Monday, 16 December at 16 UTC. On the call today, we have Mikey O'Connor, Holly Raich, Avery Doria, Graham Bunton, James Bladel, Christine Durain, Barbara Knight, and Kevin Erdman. We have apologies from Paul Diaz and Bob Mountain. And from staff, we have Lars Hoffman, Caitlin Turbijn, Carlos Alvarez, and myself, Julia Chavelin. May I please remind all participants to please state your names before speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you, and over to you, Mikey.
Thanks, Julia, and welcome all, including Carlos Alvarez from Compliance, and maybe Maggie, who I just blanked on Maggie's last name, may join us as well. So this is fabulous. Are you on, Maggie?
I don't think she's joined. Let's continue. If she joins, we'll hear from her.
Anyway, we'll sort of follow our usual routine. We've done the roll call. We'll take a moment. The agenda is short. We're going to basically continue on with the scenarios that we started working on last week, and I'll take a minute before we dive into that to sort of check signals with Carlos and Maggie as to how they want to participate in that, and I think that'll probably entertain us for the most of the day today. So that's the agenda. I'll take a pause to see if that's okay and also see if anybody needs to update their statement of interest. Okay. So, Carlos, welcome. It is lovely to have you here. And let me just sort of give you a quick sketch of what we've got on the screen. This is a mind map that we started last week.
Mm-hmm.
That is this initial set of scenarios that you probably saw the email. I basically just copy and pasted this chunk of the mind map into an email. Our thought is that what we will do, let me show you the other part of what we did last week, is what we want to do is get as many scenarios as we can and evaluate them on several dimensions. One dimension is how closely do those scenarios fit in the current policy structure? How might they fit in as yet undefined inter-registrant transfer, which is what came out of IRTPC? Does it clearly fall outside of policy, or is it a puzzler?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one dimension of the analysis. Another is, who are the parties in this scenario? Is it entirely between registrars? Is it entirely between registrants? Is it a little of both? Or is it a puzzler? And this is a part where you and Maggie and anybody else will clearly want to participate. Sort of the degree of compliance is participation in it. Clearly you have a role. You might have a role under a new inter-registrant policy if that shows up in IRTPC's implementation. Or compliance clearly does not have a role and sends people somewhere else, or if it's a puzzler. And then the fourth dimension that we will evaluate these on is how common are these? Some of these may be completely edge cases that are not very common. Others might be every day. And so we're very much in the early part of this discussion, so this is highly malleable in two ways. One, if there are more dimensions, you know, if this analysis structure isn't right, this is a good time to change it because it's, you know, we haven't started actually putting these scenarios into these buckets yet. And then the other part, and I think the part we'll probably focus on today, is fleshing out this list of scenarios, because I know James has gone back to his organization and collected a few more scenarios that he's keen to add. And one of the points that I was making before we started the recording is that this list of scenarios right now is a little bit light on the scenarios that are normal for the IRTP. And so we may want to build that part of the list a little bit more as well. So with that sort of introduction, this isn't the whole list. It keeps going, but I'm sort of limited on screen landscape in Adobe, so I have to sort of roll back and forth to show you the whole list. But it's right now it's the same list that's in the email. And so the question for you and Maggie is, would you prefer to just ride along on this part of the conversation for a while to sort of get a feel? Do you already have comments that you want to make starting
yes.
out? Whatever yep. way you yep. want to do this is fine. So okay. over to you, Carl.
Thank you. This is Carlos from the ICANN compliance staff. We did review from the InnoVet Lars shared with us a list of scenarios or instances in which there would be disputes. We have, without going into the details of each of those scenarios, we have two initial comments. First, most of those fall outside the scope of the current policy, basically because those are related to disputes between private parties, or, and by that I mean either two people fighting over a trademark, or competitors fighting among themselves, or situations of the sort, or a client fighting against the lawyer that didn't let go of their domain name. All those are, for the most part, either trademark-related or contractual disputes that are and should be, you could think, solved in the court system, the competent jurisdiction. On the other hand, we found among those types of disputes between within a single entity, like the instance that was mentioned in which the company was fighting its own employee, that should be dealt with according to the company's own internal policies. It called our attention that was included there as a matter for discussion under ICANN policy. So that's one part, the sorts of disputes and the sorts of parties that we found there. And the other matter that we wanted to bring to the discussion is the fact that, as I said, those are not currently, at least, within the scope of the ICANN policy. Those are private disputes from non-ICANN contracted parties, and currently we have no, they are not under our remit or our purview, except, of course, those cases in which trademark fights or disputes better go the UDRP path, but that's different. There's already a policy for that. And the work that's been done under the IRTP Part C, that's so much specific as well. That at least I share with you all to start the discussion today.
Terrific, Carlos. Thank you. And one of the standing rules in this working group is if I misconstrue what you say in typing the notes, you're welcome to either correct me now or correct me afterwards. There's no editorial pride in any of this. James, go ahead.
Hi, Mikey. James speaking for the transcript, and thank you, Carlos, for those comments. I think they were helpful in setting the stage as far as what ICANN's perspective is with regard to these private party disputes. I did have a question, however, and particularly because it is something I know that we have encountered as a registrar. We've been working through various issues with compliance, where occasionally someone will claim that they have lost control of a domain name, and it's only through the investigation of ICANN compliance or through the registrar or both that it becomes apparent that this is a private party dispute. So I guess what I'm saying is would you agree that it is not always apparent at the outset when you are starting to go down one of these paths that it is turning out to be a private party dispute or an internal dispute, that at the beginning at least it may look and sound like it's some sort of a transfer problem?
This is Carlos for the transcript. I'm going to word it differently. James, good morning. I'm going to say that to us, it's not always clear up front whether some of the complaints that we receive are valid complaints under the IRTP. By this, I mean that sometimes complainants are not clear in the statements that they make when they submit their complaints in whether or not they feel that their registrars breach any of the obligations that they have to comply with under the policy. Registrants, of course, don't know and don't have to know the details of the policy. We take those complaints, we analyze them. When we see that there's not enough information, we ask the complainants to provide further details. And it's with what the complainant states, we feel that there's enough to ask each of the two registrars, losing and gaining. We will ask both registrars to show proof that they did comply with all their obligations, sending the FOAs and providing the oath to the right person and all that. So what we found after we've sent those first notices to both registrars is that in some instances, oftentimes, and maybe this is the part that's related to our to what you were mentioning, James, is that some of these complaints are related to instances of hijacking of email addresses or access credentials to control panel rather than disputes between persons. Of course, they end up being disputes, but that's a consequence of the initial fact that triggered the dispute, that was the hijacking of either an email address or someone's access credentials to the control panel. And that's what changes to us the nature of the complaint. When we find that, then we stop. It's not a complaint matter. There is no violation of the IRTP. That's the reason why it's not a complaint matter. Both registrars did what they had to. The FOAs were sent to the right person. The output was sent to the right person. The timelines were complied with. Someone simply, by hijacking an email address, for example, was able to pose as the legit registrant. So that's different, and it gives it a different treat, James.
Okay, thank you. I think I got that. And I guess I was trying to help out compliance a little bit by stating that it's not always clear at the beginning because of the nature of the limited amount of information that ICANN has and public sources, like who is. It's not always clear at the beginning who is telling the truth and who isn't and what sort of a dispute it is, and it's only through working with the registrars does that sort of thing come out. And it sounds like we're saying the same thing, so I'll just...
It's not always easy to determine who's saying what's true. That's absolutely true, thanks.
Okay. Let me just finish typing. Again, feel free to correct either now or later. Chris, go ahead.
Thanks, Carlos. Thank you. That was interesting. Just a follow-up question. Chris Chaplow here for the transcript. So having investigated a little and identified that it's a private registrant dispute, presumably you then write to the person that made the complaint with almost a standard letter that you have, advise them that in your belief it is a private dispute and you would need to settle it by judicial means. So that's the first part of my question, which I assume the answer is yes. And the second part is that from your side, is that normally or in almost all cases the end of it, or then do you have come back and further discussions with people not understanding this or accepting this and having strange, to us, strange expectations. Thanks.
Okay. This is Carlos again. Regarding the first part of your question, yes, that is the next step for our team. We communicate back to the registrant, to the complainant better, letting the person know that the matter is a dispute with someone else. We suggest paths of action that they can take, either take legal action or retain legal counsel, etc. Usually that's the end of each complaint. There are some cases in which complainants write back asking some further questions. We provide the necessary explanation, but usually those are very simple after-the-fact questions, just trying to understand more details on what they should do. But that's usually the end of it.
Okay. Any other questions about that? Holly, go ahead. Holly Raish.
Thank you. Holly Raish for the record. I'm recalling, I think it was last week when James gave an instance where there was a dispute. It was clear finally, not initially, but finally, that it was, in fact, the company's domain names, not the claimant that had managed to get the domain name. And the response of James was to transfer the name back to the company because it was the company's name. Now, is that a presumption that goes in the mind map, that it's always the company's domain names? And if it's clear that the claimant doesn't have a right, it's transferred back, because otherwise the company is without a domain name for whatever length of time it takes to sort it. And I'm just wondering if that's something that, James, if you want to talk about that instance, that would be really useful. Thank you.
Holly, I don't know if James is going to do this, but what I want to do is sort of hold that question, I think, unless James really wants to dive right in. I think that's a substantially different topic than what we're zeroed in on today. Good one, but James?
Well, just very quickly, my understanding is that for us, if there's ever any discrepancy between the organization listed as the registrant and the first name, last name listed as the registrant, we believe that the organization field prevails. That is our position. That may not be a universal position, and perhaps that is something that either Carlos could clarify, or perhaps if I can believe that it is up to the discretion of the registrar and it's the will of this particular policy working group, we could set that standard. But as of my understanding, that's currently our practice.
Carlos, you want to take that one and sort of give us a reading on what the expectation for that situation is from your perspective? If you like, we could restate it, since I sort of surprised you with that question.
Can I just add one bit before Carlos? I'm sorry to interrupt. The reasoning behind that is that we've sort of treated if you look at the who is almost like a contract, service contract, or any other contract, you enter into a contract with a organization, but you are signing on behalf of an authorized individual, and so the authorized individual could change without breaking the contract, if that makes sense.
Yes.
This is Carlos. I would prefer to get back to the working group later with the answer to that question.
Yeah, if I were you, I would say exactly the same thing. And I think one of the things I would ask is that we rewrite. My notes are pretty jumbled on that one. I think we need to frame that question a little bit more clearly. So maybe we could take that as an action James, do you want to sort of restate that scenario and question and email and push it along to the left and Carlos?
Sure, I could actually put it in the chat as well if you'd like.
Chat's good. I like chat.
Okay.
But I, at the same time, I think I'm going to leave it, give Carlos the opportunity to take some time to think about that one, because that's not really what we brought him here to talk about. And so if I were him, I'd be saying, let me get back to you on that. Okay, anything else before sort of reacting to Carlos's opening comments, the scenarios falling outside of the current policy and the fact that most of these represent private disputes between non-contracted, parties, I think is the word I wanted in there. Not seeing any, I think what I would do is note that James has got his little question in the chat. And we'll take us then back to our list of scenarios. And I think what I'll do is just really quickly review them with you all. Not take very long. My observation is the same as Carlos's was, which is that most of these, to me, look like they fall outside of IRTP policy. And I would be really interested in hearing about scenarios that fall inside, clearly inside IRTP, along with any other scenarios that people want to add. But let me just give you a quick tour of the scenarios we've got so far. The first one is one that where the administrative contact transfers the name, but the registrant is challenging that transfer. The next one is the case of the recalcitrant registrar who simply is not returning phone calls. Now we've got the emergency action channel contact. That's not working. The next two is two registrants. After an inter-registrar transfer has happened, and the case we were describing here is the registrars are saying, look, we've hit all the bases, but we don't really have any in it. And I think this is one of the ones that tends to slide into the probably outside the policy zone. This one is interesting. In this case, both registrants have been in the WHOIS at one point or another, but they now disagree. Again, this probably falls outside of policy, but I'd be interested to hear. The next one is where it's a subset in a way of the administrative contact and the registrant are in two parts of an organization, and there's a disagreement between them inside the organization, and we sort of describe that in a little more detail there. The next one is a registrant who's claiming to be the registrant, and they are in conflict with their proxy service provider. And we were thinking this might be an edge case. We don't exactly know. We started talking about the role of the proxy, and we concluded that this might be a subset of the confusion within roles case, or within an organization case. This is one where we actually have lots of anecdotal examples, and from the registrar's standpoint, they've never heard of this registrant This is the case, in one case, a friend of mine had a website designer build them a site, and then the website designer went out of business, and the registrant didn't really find out that the name was getting ready to transfer until it was in auction. I guess that's this one. This one's where they're in this dispute with their website designer. This one's where, you know, in many cases these are sort of repetitive because we were brainstorming this list. And most of these are from the registrar's point of view. That here a registrant comes to them and says, "I'm the owner, but I don't control the name," and gives them a list and asks the registrar to get it back, help them get it back. We came up with some subcases there of business partners or contract disputes, or an interesting one where a company goes through an ownership or structure change and the original owner is trying to retain the name. I think this too tends to fall in the point that Carlos was making earlier, that these are disputes between registrants. This is a case where, from the standpoint of the losing registrar, I'm sorry, from the gaining registrar standpoint, the privacy service has not been removed from the name, and so the gaining registrar can't validate that the registrant is truly the registrant because there's a privacy service in the way. And we expanded this so that it's not just the losing registrar's privacy service. It could be any other privacy service, resellers or third parties that are in that. Here's one where the domain is registered by a person as part of their job, but they do it in their own personal name or under their own account at a registrar. They then depart from the company, and in a way this is an edge of the point that James was raising in the chat. You know, who trumps, the company or the employee? Here's another person working at the company, and they... This isn't malicious. This is just they've left. You know, I used to work for ICANN. I registered the name for ICANN. My name and email are all over the contact information. There's no other email, and I leave. I go get another job, and the email is deleted, and there's no way for ICANN to reclaim this name of theirs because the linkage there is broken. And then finally, there's the one where we were talking earlier on this call, where a claim gets made and facts emerge during the process of this describing the dispute. And we took some notes about that, so I won't repeat all that. I see James, my co-chair's hand up. I always pay a special attention to that. Go ahead, James.
Thanks, Mikey. And I don't know if your indulgence is worthwhile in this case, but really quickly here, I just wanted to point out the scenario, and perhaps we need to break it out here a little bit, but when we say something about an individual who registers a domain name as part of their job, and then they and the company part ways, which trumps, yeah, right there. I think there's, you know, we need to bear in mind as a working group that there are two ends of the spectrum here. One is, you know, if you can imagine someone is working for a major automotive manufacturer about to launch a new car, and they register the domain name for that new car, and then, you know, they put it in their own name, and then they want to leave, but the car is a hit. I mean, obviously they do not own the domain name or the brand or the trademark. I think those are fairly clear-cut cases. I think where it gets a little fuzzier is if the entire workforce of a company consists of two people. you know, at a certain point we cross over this fuzzy logic boundary where it's no longer a dispute between an employee and an employer, but really between two business partners or two maybe investors that are having a dispute. So some cases on one end of the spectrum are clearer, and then as it trends towards the smaller side of the scale, I think becomes much more muddied. Thanks.
I'm just going to capture that.
Yeah, I think you did very succinctly there. At the low end, this looks and acts and feels just like a private party dispute.
Yeah.
As opposed to at the high end when it's clearly an employee-employer issue.
Okay. That's a good one. I'm not seeing anybody in the queue, so, James, I know at least you had some more use cases you wanted to throw into the pile. So I think at this point...
That was like, mainly the main one, my team.
Oh, okay. All right.
Was just to describe that that spectrum. I think that, we could also point out here, and I think that the more I think about my additional scenarios, the more I believe that they are variations of the last scenario, where that this is a private party dispute between competing claims for registrant status.
Oh, this and, one that we just added.
Right, and I guess there are there are a whole universe of routes by which someone could bring a case to your doorstep, but they almost all would fall into that bucket.
Okay. Well, then let's go back to my question, which is, what are the scenarios that are clearly within the IRTP, that for which the IRTP was clearly intended? Because on this list right now, two that are clearly, in my mind, inside of this are the first two. And that seems like a very small group of scenarios for a policy that we've labored over for 5 years. So I'd like a longer list so that we could point to that. James, go ahead.
I think that, I believe Chris Dean raised this on the last call. The scenario where a registrar is not authorizing a transfer out or is not providing an auth info code within the required time period. I think those are clear cases where they are falling within the policy, and we have clear precedent from ICANN compliance on how they can proceed to make inquiries and possibly sanctions against that registrar.
This is
so it's not just the transfers that happened, but the transfers that didn't happen but were requested.
Okay.
This is Carlos, is something else to add? Also, when the auth code is sent to the wrong contact or it's sent to the account holder that may not even be listed in the WHOIS output, when the FOAs are not sent to either of the transfer contacts, those are also matters that fall strictly under the IRTP.
Say that one again, Carlos. The connection you've got is just ever so slightly blurring what you're saying, and so it's hard for me to follow. So I just want to do that one over again, and I'll capture it. Sorry to be so
okay.
Dense.
Two instances. Can you understand me better?
Yeah, that's great.
Okay. Two instances to add. First, when the auth code is sent to either a wrong WHOIS contact or to the account holder that may not even be listed as a WHOIS contact. And second, when the FOAs are not sent to either of the two transfer contacts. Those fall strictly under the IRTP.
the first one, you had a note, and I wasn't typing fast enough. So it was when the auth code is sent to the wrong Whois contact, or, and then something.
Or to the account holder that sometimes is not even listed as a contact in the Whois information.
That sometimes
is not listed in the Whois.
Cool. All right. Sorry, I'm so halting on that. It's probably my phone line that's doing it. Those are good. How about some more? This is so far the universe. Whoops. This isn't what I was intending to do. This is the universe of things that so far fall within the IRTP in our use cases.
This is Carlos again. I would think that when James mentioned registrars not allowing the transfers, he was referring to not unlocking the domains. Or allowing the registrants to unlock the domains themselves?
Cool. Any more? This is better. I like this better. I'm going to leave it as sort of an action for us all to flesh out the list of things that fall within the IRTP as it stands today. Now,
so
one of the things...
Mike, if I may, because this can provide further clarification to the working group. To us in compliance, and this is Carlos again, to us in compliance, a valid IRTP complaint is that in which the ideal complaint, that is one in which the complainant states that either the registrant was not able to retrieve the auth code from the control panel, or the registrar did not provide the auth code within the 5 days, or the registrant did not have the means provided by the registrar to unlock the domain name, or the registrant requested the registrar to unlock the domains and the registrar did not unlock them within the 5 days. Then, as I was saying, when the losing registrar does not send the FOA or sends it to someone who is not a transfer contact, or sends the auth code to someone who is not the registered name holder, or does not even send it, or the instances in which the gaming registrar would not send the FOA, or would send it to someone who is not listed as a transfer contact, or the instance in which the gaming registrar would allow the transfer without receiving confirmation after sending the FOA, or would allow the transfer without receiving the auth code, which should be technically impossible, I know, for theoretical purposes at least. Those would be probably all the cases that we would consider strictly IRTP related.
You'll notice I stopped typing because I wanted to listen, and also because it seemed to me that that was a list that maybe I can drop an action item on Lars to capture out of the transcript. Lars, are you okay with doing that? Because I think that would be hugely helpful to capture carefully and well.
No problem at all.
Cool. Because I think that's precisely what I was looking for. And I didn't want to let my not so great note taking skills get in the way of you running through that list, Carlos. So that's wonderful. Thank you.
Sure.
And what we'll do is, Lars can capture that list. We'll send it to the email list to make sure it's right with you, Carlos, and then I'll just strip it into this pile. That's great. Okay, so that's at least cheered me up enough that I'm going to move on then to the next thing that I'm really interested in, which is that we have sort of a moving target in the inter-registrant transfer part of IRTPC, which is right now in implementation. And what I'm curious about is whether we could go through the remaining ones on this list. I'm not sure we can do this effectively on the call, but I want to plant this idea in your minds. And it seems to me that one of the things that would help the implementation review team for this IRTPC policy would be some use cases of things that fall clearly within the inter-registrant transfer that we described in IRTPC and things that clearly do not. And since this is coming as a little bit of a surprise to you all, including me in a way, I wasn't expecting us to get through this other stuff this fast. Maybe we can just sort of brainstorm our way through it for now and think about this over the next few days on the list, because one of the things that I think we, especially James and I, need to do is go back to the IRTPC language and see to what extent we intended contract disputes between registrants to be included in that policy. And I think that gets us squarely into the question, is it the same dispute resolution mechanism? What started all this is the access of the registrant to the TDRP, and whether the TDRP is a big enough mechanism to resolve such a broad set of disputes. So anyway, that's introducing a tangled ball of yarn, and I'll hand it over to James for a minute.
Hi, Mikey. Thanks. James speaking for the transcript. I just wanted to point out that what we could do, one possible way to untangle the ball of yarn, would be to go back, because if memory serves, IRTPC, what we really were creating was a way to handshake authorizations between two parties to effect a change of registrant and the registrar's role in doing so. So once we, once Lars has so graciously recreated the list that Carlos stated a few minutes ago, I think we can probably take that and start to look at how we are modeling IRTPC and those requests for and granting of authorizations on that list. And then I think that then the dispute for a change of registrant policy looks a lot like the current dispute for a change of registrar, in that, did the authorizations occur as they were, prescribed to do, and were they legitimate? And then you could sort of, maybe I'm being optimistic here, but sort of kind of hold up your hands and say, without diving into the substance of the claim, just checking that the paint by numbers occurred in the right order and that the colors match. That's just one thought on how we could maybe approach these two.
A really intriguing thought. because, you know, I think that one of the things that this conversation has clearly identified for me is that there's a very large body of disputes which don't really belong in ICANN's remit. They aren't now, and they probably shouldn't ever be. And the nice thing about going through that list and then mapping it over to the inter-registrant transfer is that that would, I think, sharpen up that distinction a bit. So I'm keen on that idea. What's people's reactions to that strategy? Because if you all, the rest of you like that approach to the next step, I would be inclined to just end the conversation today. We're only 10 minutes from the top of the hour. Give you a few minutes back in your day and pick it up from there. Holly's okay with it. Anybody, I think maybe another way to ask that question is, anybody got a serious reservation about that approach as our next step? James, go ahead.
Actually, Mikey, just wanted to say I have no problems with that. I do want to perhaps, I guess this goes to item number 4 on our agenda, and I don't know if I'm skipping ahead, but just looking at the calendar and wondering if we're going to start seeing folks, members of the working group, taking, you know, sort of prolonged vacations or expecting, anticipating absences between beginning on the 20, I believe it's the 23rd, and then the 30th, and just wondering if that's everybody, you know, if what everyone's schedule is looking out like.
Yeah, I'm looking. You are all looking at my calendar. Sorry about that.
I'm sorry. And with that, I just got to see here, and I do have to drop. And I apologize. Thank you very much, Mike.
Okay. See you around, James. James is like many of my colleagues in the working group world, has gotten really busy, and so this happens to both of us a lot, and so. Thanks for hanging in this long, James. I think I'm going to take a sort of unilateral approach to this and say that the odds that we would be able to do a meeting on the 23rd or the 30th are essentially zero. So that would get us out to the 6th, which seems comfortably after the holiday season. And so why don't we skip the next 2 calls and pick it up again on the 6th as a plan. And Julia and Lars, if you all could sort of push the word out about that, that would be great. Okay. Pardon me?
Just saying, no problem.
Okay. All right. Well, I really want to thank Carlos and Maggie for joining us. This is hugely helpful, and you, Carlos, in one list have advanced the ball quite far for us, and I just want to, I'm sure James will share this sentiment, express my appreciation for you joining us, and extend an invitation to join us anytime you want, especially when we're in the very core of the policymaking cycle. It's hugely helpful to have you involved while we're formulating some of this. And so just a personal note of thanks on that. I think with that, we'll call it a day. Thanks, everybody. Have wonderful holidays, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks with lists and ideas for the future. And with that, Julia, I think you can end the recording, and we'll call it a day. Thanks.
Thank you.